Ready?
Looks just fine. You're on.
Okay. Good afternoon.
The gavel first.
I'll open the House Interim Committee on General Government Consumer Protection. The date is September 12th, 2012. Welcome all the committee members that are here. Just missing a couple. And we have two items on the agenda this afternoon. We're going to...
Brian's birthday. I'm going to say something.
Who's?
Representative Clinton.
It's the 2019. Happy birthday.
40.
Really?
40 today.
Yeah. Brian, congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
My grandson's is this month, later this month.
That one's September 11th.
So we're first going to have a really interesting informational hearing on audits of the state boards and commission, and we have, is all three going to come up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, have all three of the people in the Secretary of State will come up, please introduce yourself, and we look forward to your testimony.
Kendall is not in the Secretary of State's office.
So she's I apologize, Kendall.
Oh, no worries.
Kendall is, as works for the governor's office, is a director of executive appointments. Thank you. I don't think we've met.
No, we haven't.
Thank you.
It's nice to meet you.
So go ahead and either we're going to start off with Barry first.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chair Wisman, Holvey, and members of the committee, for the record, Barry Back, Deputy Secretary of State. Representative Clem, happy birthday. Welcome to your parties.
Oh, thank you.
I'm just going to give you a very high level overview of the audit, in particular hitting a couple of points that the Secretary wanted to make sure were communicated to you as policymakers, some of the findings that she found more interesting in the audit. And then Gary's here to talk more details about the findings, and then obviously Kendall's here to talk about the Governor's Office perspective. In this audit, we wanted to provide an overview of the structure and operations and functions of state boards and commissions in Oregon, and to identify common risks and opportunities for improvements in the governance and operations of boards to promote better accountability and transparency. When we started, the most interesting thing we found was that there was no single comprehensive list of boards and commissions in Oregon. And so we attempted to create such a list, and for those of you who have an electronic copy or the printed copy, the back of the audit is an appendix listing the more than 250 boards and commissions we identified, along with some common data points around how they're appointed and where their budget lies and when they were created and when they last met. I think that since the release of the audit, Kendall has increased the list, finding more, and will probably continue to do so as she continues to do her work, and hopefully the governor's office will maintain the list so there is one point to go to and actually answer the question of how many are there and what are they. We found common issues and areas of risk among boards with small staff. There was insufficient training or unclear expectations of board members and staff. In many cases, board members of some of these boards and commissions may have policy or industry-specific knowledge about the topic of the board, but may not have specific management experience, or it may not be clear that there is an expectation of their responsibility in managing the staff and the budget and the operations of the boards or commission, and ultimately to whom board members end up being held accountable. Finally, from the Secretary's perspective, having been a member of the legislature for many years, she strongly recommends that you as policymakers look at standard sunrise and sunset mechanisms when and if you choose to create the next new board or commission.
Could you repeat those, please?
Sunset? Yes, some sort of standardized sunrise and sunset, and I'll explain that a little bit more, Mr. Co-Chair. When we looked at the statutes that created most of these boards and commissions, they varied widely. And in many cases, specific issues were left unaddressed. And I think Gary can talk a little bit more in specific about those. But making sure that when you create a new board, you have a checklist of things that the statute should address, and that there be some process for review as to whether the board is continuing to meet its purpose and whether that purpose continues to exist, and whether or not that board should at some point be sunsetted, and have a process for that so that you create them all sort of in the same format and there's a process to look at whether they all should continue or be sunsetted at some point. finally, I guess I've got finally here twice. So finally, as a side note from our perspective, it's not really a question about the number of boards or commissions that Oregon has. Washington has more than twice as many, or did before they recently consolidated. It's really about making sure that risks, especially common areas of risks, are mitigated, that board members and the operations of these boards and commissions are transparent and accountable. And if you do those, and you continue to evaluate the continuing need of them, most of the issues that we identified, I think, can be addressed. So I'm happy to answer any questions now, or just turn it over to Gary and let him get into the meat of it.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and start with Gary, and we'll have
to... Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Hovey and Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. Many states around the country utilize boards, commissions, councils to allow subject matter experts to provide input into their public governance. Oregon has a long history of those boards. It had actually the pilot's board before the state of Oregon was even founded. So it has incorporated boards within its governance structure throughout its entire history. And many state leaders have tried to contain the number of boards as they've grown. Now, you know, starting with one at the inception of Oregon, we now have over 250, as Barry Pack said. These boards fall into five major categories. They are advisory, in that these are appointed members who advise on policy matters, governing, in which case they may direct a state agency.
How many of those governing?
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have that broken out. I can get that to you. We have the governing, which actually direct a state agency, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, for example. Licensing, the Board of Nursing is an example of that, where they examine and license occupations or professions. Policy boards, they have statutory power to make policy decisions and enforce regulations. And then they're finally the judgment-type boards that conduct hearings and rule on individual cases. For example, the Workers' Compensation Board. On page 7 of our report...
That gives you the numbers, committee members.
On page 7. So that gives you a sense. The large majority are advisory boards. So we looked at what other states had done, what other audit shops had looked at in terms of their boards and commissions, and what we had done historically. And we found that they were susceptible to certain problems, especially the smaller ones, where they cannot segregate their financial activities, or they may lack the breadth of knowledge and expertise to administer complex procurement or personnel matters. So they do tend to run into more problems than larger agencies do. And the boards themselves may not bring that kind of expertise either. What we found was that those board members are not always aware of their responsibilities or have the expertise to carry them out. In some cases, for example, one board member that we talked to said, I didn't know it was my responsibility to oversee the procurement and financial practices to make sure they were done correctly. So to get a better understanding of those problems, we originally intended to survey every board and get a sample from its composition of members in order to get insights into what they were doing and their weaknesses. That's where we ran into the problem that there was not a comprehensive list of all the boards. The governor's office keeps a good list of all those that the governor appoints, but there are many other appointment processes that occur in the state, and those are not centralized in any way. And the contact information that we had in many cases was outdated, so we weren't able to easily approach those boards, and we had to individually go through and contact just a much smaller sample of boards to get an understanding of what kinds of expectations they had heard in terms of getting appointed to the board, what kinds of activities they performed, and where they provided that information. We also looked at strategies that other states had used to manage their boards, and we found, as Barry said, sunrise and sunset programs are a common way for states to manage the number of boards, because they also run into the proliferation of boards over time. And, for example, Colorado has a sunset provision that generally discourages boards that are not related to public health, safety, or welfare. Maine also has about a dozen questions that it asks in order to ensure that those boards are providing meaningful service to the state of Maine. Sunset reviews are on the other side of it. The sunrise, those are kind of a filter to prevent boards from unnecessarily being created. Sunset are periodic reviews to see whether boards are continuing to serve the purpose that they were intended. Texas requires each licensing board to undergo a sunset review every 12 years. Oregon actually had a sunset law in place from 1977 until 1993, but the sunset board was sunsetted. In its 16 years, it only eliminated four boards, and I think the legislature, in its wisdom, realized that it was not performing its duty and no longer was needed, apparently. Other states have eliminated boards by consolidating them, finding very similar missions and duties and being able to put those together into a more unified kind of a board, or creating ad hoc committees where it was a specific purpose, it had a limited duration, and it ended when that task was done. California eliminated its credit union advisory committee and relied instead on the Secretary of Commerce to create task forces as needed. And in fact, here in 2011, the legislature created the task force on military families rather than creating a board. So what we ultimately recommended, and we recognize the value of boards and commissions, and we think that it's just almost requires a continual process of review, is that there be a single list of all the boards and commissions and their members and key information that the governor work with the legislature and Department of Administrative Services to consider the strategies that other states have applied. Ensure that all board members receive training on expectations and the kinds of rules and procedures they need to ensure that the staff of those boards comply with. Consider whether statutes of the board set clear expectations regarding their authority and what their duties are. Require periodic fiscal and operational reports from the boards. Establish a mechanism for handling complaints about the board staff, the board members, the board operations, so that there's some effort to look at the quality of services that are provided, and then periodically review the activities that those boards report to see whether they could be eliminated or consolidated with another. So that's essentially a quick view of our audit. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
I think what Director Clausen will go ahead and ask your testimony and have questions of the panel at the end. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holby, and members of the committee. My name is Kendall Clausen. I'm the Director of Executive Appointments for Governor John Kitzhaber. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and happy birthday, Representative Clem.
Thank you.
I will, too, say the 40s are awesome. So as Director of Executive Appointments, I have a unique bit of access to the full spectrum of activities that are related to boards and commissions throughout our state. I have a front row seat to their formation. I play a role in the recruitment of candidates for service, and I work with board members around the inevitable organizational challenges that emerge when any group of people tackle projects as a team. In many cases, I remain the first point of contact for most of the Oregonians who serve on our boards and commissions. Boards, task forces, and commissions are all formed for worthy reasons. Often they're a necessary tool to substantively advance policy discussions for complex issues. Both the legislative and executive branches use boards to engage subject matter experts and the public at large to ensure that many different perspectives are represented and heard. Nevertheless, while the governor's office agrees with the audit recommendation and the testimony of the Secretary of State's office regarding the need for more training, transparency, and accountability for boards, we also feel that state government must evaluate the entire system that creates and utilizes boards in Oregon to comprehensively address the issues raised by the audit. Currently, we have nearly 300 boards and more than 2,400 members. In addition to the recommendations that the Secretary of State focused on, the question becomes, how do we, both the executive and legislative branches, work together to ensure that its boards are a functional and useful tool while reducing the likelihood that our same commitment to governance does not become unwieldy or too expensive? Since the audit, the governor's office has worked with DAS and has had preliminary conversations with the legislature about ways in which the creation and formation of boards can be more tightly controlled and managed. It's important to stress that boards do have a cost. While they're relatively low cost compared to the implementation of a new program, member recruitment, hosting meetings and interviews, creating documents, producing reports, and providing staff support to board members, administrators, and key stakeholders requires and demands resources. In most cases, those resources are relatively minor for a single board. However, if we multiply this by 300 boards, the commitment accumulates substantially. The governor's office, DAS, state agencies, and the legislature all devote resources to staffing and supporting boards. Building and providing additional training and oversight will certainly require more support for each of these participants. To that end, working with the executive branch and the legislature to accurately quantify the cost of an individual board will help agencies better support our boards and help all of us understand their cumulative costs. One idea that we're interested in exploring is a collaborative effort between the executive and legislative branches to develop a method to determine the actual fiscal impact of creating new boards and commissions. With that goal in mind, as we move forward, we would also like to consider that prior to the creation of a new board or task force, we determine whether an existing board might have the capacity to take on the proposed task as an area-specific project. In other words, can a currently functioning board fulfill the assignment rather than generating an entirely new body to meet that need? We're also interested in working with the legislature to provide clear, achievable, and most importantly, time-specific goals to boards so that we can ensure a clear and methodical understanding of measurable successes with cohesive timelines in achieving those goals. There's no doubt in our minds that boards bring diverse groups of thoughtful experts together in ways that might not otherwise happen. Their utility cannot be understated nor underestimated. As the primary supporter of these boards and commissions, we feel that it's our shared responsibility to create a system that's efficient, transparent, manageable, and cost-effective for their benefit and for our own. And so with that, I'm also open to any questions that you have, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Committee members, this is a lot of information. The report you have in front of you, I hope we'll have a lot of comments from you and discussions of recommendations of how to proceed. So who wants to go first? Okay. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thanks for the testimony. Really appreciate it. And thanks for the work. And talk us through how you're thinking about this. Seems to me of the tensions, among the various tensions, one of them is merely having a big standing board and commission army is a big undergirder of our sort of civic infrastructure in our state, right? Having 2,400 people around the state who purportedly care about stuff and are linked to other people who care about stuff matters a lot, I think, in having an informed, active electorate that, you know, is able to wield power as the electorate. The other, and the recommendation that concerned me a bit was saying, well, if we have a new initiative in a bill, we'll give it to an existing board. The concern I would have, or that I might have, would be that the that recommendation would have a would feel of different heft with an existing group than with a group formed for the for its purpose, right? In fact, the reason the bill might get passed with a new group might in fact be because one of the places that might be taking up such a thing was not taking up such a thing. And merely saying please, please, and in a statute saying it will doesn't mean they'll actually do what's necessary. They might do the letter of the statute, but that's not the same as actually trying to accomplish something. So I'd hope we'd also consider, and I don't hate the idea of having more boards and commissions. I don't hate the idea and working on the performance stuff. All the performance stuff I think is great. But talking about why either growing the number of boards and commissions or replacing, right, saying, all right, for no net loss of matter and energy, you know, for as we grow boards and commissions, we're going to try to sunset others. Talk to us about why those are inferior options to tasking an existing body with a new task.
I'll take this one. Co-chairs, Representative Smith. I don't think that we're suggesting that we do one or the other. I think at this point we have a pretty giant system that is streaming in a lot of different directions. I think what we noted the most in the Secretary of State's audit was that the way in which we formulate these boards and the tasks that they're given is just as important as the task itself. And so I think that the governor's office is very open to looking at the most productive ways for assigning the work. There will be times when a panel of experts is required to come together that's not necessarily about what's already in place. We just want to be open to giving the opportunity to current boards who are working in that arena currently to grapple with maybe a next layer of the work. But if it does require that a certain set of experts are necessary to examine a task or a project, that we at least have the foresight to think about what are we asking them, how long are we asking them to do it, rather than here's an idea and we'll see you in 10 or 20 years and good luck with that. Structure and systems are necessary for this to function well.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
And I have another lame duck question. And agree with the thinking about structures and systems and thinking about how do we invigorate the boards and commissions, how do we hold them accountable, how do we measure performance, how do we make people feel like the input they're giving is well used or used at all. I think that's all great. And so I guess just the thought cockroach that I try to implant into your brain is that is informed to me by, I think it was the number two sort of co-founder of the Peace Corps, whose mantra was that campaigns are effective, bureaucracies aren't. Now, I think that can be overstated, but very often a group of people convened for a purpose, not because they're different personnel or more expert in the arena than a different group that might be an existing group. They might even be less expert, but who have the love for the sea to build a particular ship can be really valuable, and maybe more valuable than handing it off to the group that's been there for, you know, 20 years or whatever. So I just offer that thought. It's probably well on your mind. You already figured it all out, but it was what was on my mind.
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, I agree.
Mr. Kutcher, may I comment just briefly on that?
Please.
Representative Smith, I think that's a piece of what we would include in a sunrise provision. So you would go through a series of questions. You know, is there somebody who could do this now? No. Okay. Does it need to be a separate group of people with this expertise? Yes. Okay. Is there an end point? Yes, there is. Okay. What is it? Identify it. We you and I worked together on a council a session or two ago where we went through all those very questions, and we created something that needed new people involved, a purpose to be met, and an end date. And that's sort of what we're recommending in a sunrise provision.
Great.
Who would be on that sunrise committee?
Mr. Co-Chair, I think it would be the legislature who would probably take that on. You could designate a committee to review new legislation as it comes through. Or
I wanted to clarify that, because of my brief review of the report said that the governor actually, you know, some are not do not come through the legislative process. The governor does on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Cotier, I believe this is part of the issue. So some of the boards are run through the governor's office, but others are done through the legislature. Others are done by outside groups. So I think part of the creation part of this discussion is to line some of those things up so we know who's on first.
So would the governor's office be, you know, agreeable to having the legislature and the governor's office and whoever else, you know, do that review of Sun Rising committee?
Absolutely.
I think my feeling is this committee would agree that we want to be sure that before we establish something, it meets the needs of the citizens.
Mr. Cotier, I appreciate that greatly. I think the thing that I can lead off with the most is that we feel strongly about the need for this to be a collaborative effort because we're all engaged in this work. We all have our purpose around it. So it's necessary for us to all have our say in how this works, and we're excited, actually, to see that collaboration.
Very good. Other committee members?
Come on, guys.
I can't. Birthday boy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are there boards or commissions that exist outside the scope of having been created by statute?
To my knowledge.
Mr. Chair, there is the Columbia River Gorge Commission, which is created under federal law. Mm-hmm. So there are occasionally those that are imposed by the federal government. Mm-hmm. For example, certain grants or federal funding are tied to certain kinds of boards for oversight.
Go ahead, please.
So,
Brian.
I mean, I think for the most part, really, the advice we're getting is before you legislators keep creating these things, maybe you ought to set some of these parameters and you're offering to help, which is nice because you end up having to deal with them, particularly in the governor's office. And so, you know, I don't, from a Sunrise Committee standpoint, it's not like they end up getting created without parameters by anybody other than us sitting up here. So it's probably good advice. I certainly do feel like there's some where we'll do the review and decide, like the independent advisory board at the state hospital. No way that the things that led to that, the creation of that, the federal DOJ investigation, the ongoing problems, no way would we say that one needs to be, you know, time limited. It was an ongoing problem for decades that led to needed accountability there that the legislature simply cannot provide. We can't be out there every day reviewing things. We can't. There's no chance to do it. Other ones, you know, certainly probably could be time limited. So having been on one for 6 years, my wife was on one for 10 years, I'm a big fan of getting free labor out of people, and training is important, but they, I think, play a crucial role. And so a lot of the suggestions you've had are good. I'm not interested in overall trying to figure out how to get rid of them, and I don't think anybody's saying that. But having some better equipment and options for people who are on them, because they're giving a lot of free time to the state, and the last thing I want to do is make it, you know, more difficult. And in fact, in many cases, most of us who were on them would have liked to have them be time limited, so we weren't on there for, you know, in my wife's case, 11 years, I believe, and I was always complaining, it's got to end someday, and like they keep asking me, and I feel bad saying no. So it's not a bad thing, but I do want to reiterate that there are some that shouldn't end, and I don't even know if I would say you automatically sunset the ones right off the bat that you know should never end, but if you do, you do. They'll get renewed. It won't be that big of a deal.
I think those are good comments, Representative, but also they could not, the sunrise or the sunsetting committee could also look at a mission statement change. You know, maybe you need to, you know, get rid of them, but yeah, they need to be redirected or look at what they're doing and say redirect it.
Sure.
So, Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see at the end of the report there's a list of a dozen different commissions that didn't respond to the survey. I have to assume that they're not doing a whole lot is probably why. You've got the Blueberry Commission and the Tall Fescue Commission. Of the ones that did respond, how many did you see? Just did you think that they're maybe not working very hard or they don't really have much of a purpose at this point? Did you delve that far into it, or what's your gut instinct?
Co-chairs, Representative Sheehan, we focused mostly on kind of the administrative and governance functions that they had there and how frequently they met. And we did find some that met infrequently or didn't have a quorum, but I couldn't characterize it at this point to kind of judge the percentage. We had tried to reach as many as we could. We took a sample, and we didn't get a response. So we've thought about highlighting those non-respondents in future surveys, since our view was that we were trying to do this to inform the public, and after three or four attempts to get a response and not getting one, we thought we would just mention that they hadn't responded. So that was the purpose for putting that there.
Now that we're not looking specifically at money, but how much money was going to these agencies that didn't respond?
Co-Chair Wisden, I'd have to go back and look and see. Many of them are funded by like the fees of agricultural interests, or there are some that are you know, professional fees pay for them, or they are simply they have staff who are assigned on a part-time basis to support their meetings. If you looking at the 250 to 300 boards and commissions out there, about 100 have staff that answer to them in that they are providing governance or licensing type activities or judgment type activities. Those are the ones that, from our standpoint as auditors, we have the greatest concerns about. The advisory, the policy, and so forth oftentimes don't have staff, don't cost a lot of money, but those that are actually overseeing employees are the ones where we think there's greater risks in terms of possible fraud, misspending, violation of state rules. So from that standpoint, there's about 100 that we look at, and we look at the accountability, and it raises questions as auditors, which is accountability is one of our key elements that we see that ultimately employees, corrections officer, for example, you can see the chain of accountability up to the governor. In these boards and commissions, the chain of accountability goes to the board, and the governor can appoint those board members, but ultimately the day-to-day oversight is relegated to a director, and from the standpoint of the board's involvement, it's rather it's not as much as we'd like as auditors.
Questions? Thank you very much. Co-Chair Hobie, you had a question, I think.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the audit, and just wanted to go look at another aspect, I guess, that really hasn't, I don't think, been addressed. You know, when we're talking about sunrises and sunsets of the new boards, you know, was there any thought or discussion about looking at those same questions for all the existing boards that exist? And I say that because when I look at your audit and go through some of the history on it, it appears there's been a mountain of efforts throughout time by governors and legislators in the past trying to get a handle of the unwieldy aspects of having a government spread out amongst so many boards and commissions without really having a great deal of, I guess, intercourse between the boards and the legislature and the governor's office, perhaps. And in fact, that's led to many recommendations over the time to look at some of these overlapping boards and talking about consolidation or elimination of boards that have no more useful purpose, perhaps. And every effort that I've seen that has been attempted at that has failed, it appears, or just about failed, I won't say totally. And to finish up on that comment, I'd just like you to comment on whether or not your audit revealed a need for looking at the existing boards and their functionality, their purpose, their missions, and trying to decipher whether or not they're really effective, or one, or would that their function be better served in a government agency as opposed to being, when it comes to enforcement and licensing or whatever the case may be, would it be better served by an agency of government instead of a board or commission? And finally, would has the governor's office, and it's probably not the Secretary of State's position, but the governor's office certainly thought about the recommendations that have come in the past. I know Governor Kulongoski made a recommendation, according to the audit, to eliminate or consolidate up to 60 boards. And that effort didn't go very far, I believe. I think they only addressed 4 boards. So as the governor's office looked at that recommendation, are they making a similar recommendation on that, or are they passing on that discussion?
Mr. Co-Chairs, we are certainly examining everything that's in front of us. It would be reckless for us to assume that we will ignore one side of this discussion. I think the governor is very methodical in everything he does, and that includes this process. We're really grateful to have the opportunity to work in partnership with the Secretary of State's office to give us a starting point. As you heard in the initial part of this presentation, we weren't completely certain even where we were beginning, which boards were around, which ones were working, which ones were led by whom, if the appointing body had the authority to remove people. There were still a lot of details that we weren't clear on. So at this point, what we're trying to do is to methodically go through the information that the audit put in front of us and look at every opportunity that we have to make adjustments, particularly around reducing risk. That's the biggest part for us, is how do we keep the state from opening its doors to liabilities that we can contain if we're looking at all the different components. So I say that to say that we're open to looking at everything. I'm very cautious to come out of the gate at this point to say that our goal is to consolidate any of these boards. I think we need to examine first how many we have, which ones are functional, what their needs are, who's aligned with them, so that we know what we're working with.
Okay. Co-Chair Hovey, if I could add to that. We intentionally put some quotes in here from previous governors because we thought it sent two messages. One was that this has been a long-term issue that the state government has tried to address periodically, but also that it's something that needs to be looked at periodically in the future. For example, in 1955, there were about 100 boards. There are only 50 of those boards in existence now than were in existence back then, but we've got another 200 or so on top of that. So to the degree that there's always going to be a need for constant pruning of the tree, so to speak, that there will be offshoots and branches that can be taken off, but other ones will come up, that is part of, I think, the change that government needs to reflect in how it manages its boards. So some of the governors came out strongly against the not large number of boards and commissions and their proliferation, but they continue to grow. So I guess the third message is don't give up hope if you can't get rid of a lot of them. But every year, a few might end up creating a more responsive set of boards and commissions to the needs of Oregonians.
Thank you very much. Jan and I, in preparing for this meeting, we were looking at, in your audit, you also looked at training of the board members and also removal of the board members. Could you briefly talk to the committee about those issues and if they need to be addressed or, refined?
Would you like to take that?
Sure. Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Holvey, training is essential in this process. I think we heard a bit of that when we heard some of the stories about board members not having a clear expectation of their roles and responsibilities. Each board member receives a manual that we update on a regular basis, so everyone that is confirmed to join a board receives that information. However, we haven't had a face-to-face training with our board members since 2007. That was removed from the budget. It was a way of saving money, and so At this point, we do our best to inform new members as they're brought on and complete the confirmation process, what their basic expectations are, and we provide them with that manual. However, it doesn't, because of the broad number of them, each one of those boards has their own mechanisms, their own expectations. So that's one of the areas where there could potentially be a gap or a risk in terms of lack of information.
You know, Representative Clem brought up how many people and how many volunteer hours we get, but you better be sure it's directed towards the mission that they're doing. So did we find any, you know, real bad things where we need to address sooner as far as board training or how to remove someone? If they're, I talked to Lucy Baker. I sit on the Asian and Pacific Island Affairs Advocacy Commission, and she says, I give them the book, but she says, you know, not much time for individual training. And she says, but, you know, she says, that's a good point. Maybe we should at least have them sign that they received the document and they know that they're responsible and they do it representing the state, they're representing the governor and that commission. And, you know, we always, all of us have been involved with volunteers where you want them, my wife, that's her job. She gets paid to do that. And you never fire them, but sometimes they can embarrass the organization by speaking out as a, you know, representing the commission or the board when they're not really, it's their own personal opinion because it hasn't been, the board has not voted on it. Any.
Co-Chair Wisnant, just one example was the Oregon Commission for the Blind, where we had been working with the director over a number of years on issues around procurement practices, payroll practices, and general spending. And ultimately, we ended up going to the board, and we said, we want a response from the board, not from the director. And the board stepped up to that responsibility. So I think that they recognize that doing the business in a business-like manner is like the first step of a good organization, and then accomplishing its mission is the other key element of it. So to the degree that we can engage board members more in, you know, ensuring that responsibilities are carried out, it's important. And I guess one other example outside of this, but a similar kind of a pattern was at the Willamette Education Service District, where we had a Board of Education that really had some governance breakdowns between it and the superintendent. It's not uncommon. Oregon is not the only one. We look at the city of Kansas City and how they monitor their boards and commissions and their nonprofits. And we looked and we found problems in many other places that this is not uncommon for a group of volunteers who are brought in who have a passion for a particular interest, but the day-to-day, you know, details of operational or management issues are not of primary concern to them, but they need to be a little bit higher priority.
So do we depend upon the executive director to bring that attention to the board or to the governor or to the legislature when you got a, you know, maybe someone that got themselves in there that had a personal agenda and they're using the board for that personal agenda?
Co-chairs, I think that's the important point. So you've got the potential for a breakdown in two directions. So we have to assume that the executive director has all the tools and resources that they need to continue to convey that ongoing mission, time, resources, those types of mechanisms, and then also ensuring that those board members, some of whom may operate as the supervisor of the executive director. So you've got that sort of two-way street that happens between those two entities. So that oversight issue becomes really important. Certainly it comes from our office as much as we can. We know that our partners in the legislature also provide that information as best that they can. But I think this is where we will benefit from really clarifying roles and expectations, both of directors, board members, and those that appoint them.
Good point. Committee members, I have a couple more things, but I hope that so.
Mr. Chair, may I comment briefly on your question? I think one of the purposes or the thinking behind our audit was not necessarily to provide specific recommendations about specific actions that needed to be taken immediately or in the near future, rather to sort of spark this kind of a dialogue, to say, look, here are some common issues that we see among boards, that other states see among boards. Here are a variety of strategies that have been used or could be used to address them. Now what we need is exactly what's happening here, conversations between our office and the governor's office and the legislature about these. Where are the priorities? Where are the resources available to address it? You can't possibly tackle every issue tomorrow. No one has the resources or the capability to do that, but this kind of dialogue where we consider what are the appropriate responses, what are the highest priorities, and then work collaboratively to reach those are I think, my expected outcome of this audit.
Good comments. Committee members? Okay, I have two more questions. I usually don't talk this much. Director Clausen, the governor, which we change every 8 years or 4 years or whatever, some of our commissions and they really are another layer. I mean, it's a chain of command. If you look at OTC, the Transportation Commission, they have a lot of power. And so the governor is delegating that power to OTC. They're not elected officials, but how does the governor's office, I mean, does he appoint them? Does he monitor that much? Is that, you know, they're actually operating, they operate an agency. Their decisions and everything is operating at this sort of like a city council is operating that ODOT. So is that good, bad, problems, too many? And again, I understand and I certainly endorse what Representative Clem said about, I think it's great to get citizens involved and the hours they put in is they're not rewarded or in financial ways for all the work they do, and we really appreciate it. So. Can you comment on that?
Yes, sir. Mr. Co-Chair, I think this is the great part of this system. So while we're looking at how can we always strengthen and build and support and adequately provide oversight, we have amazing people throughout the state who have a sense of expertise that we can't always find just amongst ourselves. So we have this great opportunity to really tap into the talent and the skill sets and the brilliance of our communities. So when the governor appoints members to these boards and commissions, we're actually quite thoughtful around that. It would be very easy to just rubber stamp random people and put them on these boards and pray that everything goes okay, but really we're representing not only the governor and the legislature but the state, and we want to do right by that. So we spend a lot of time in the front end of this process identifying appropriate people to participate. We do our best with our team of policy advisors and our partners in the agencies and in the Department of Administrative Services and our partners in the legislature to make sure that people have the needs and their needs met and the resources and tools that they need to be successful. I don't think any one of us wants to put our community members in front of things that either they're not capable of or they're not well supported around, which is one of the reasons why we were so willing to partner with the Secretary of State's office to figure this out. At the end of the day, each one of us has a certain set of responsibilities to stand in front of the state and say we will protect its citizens. We will make sure that the work that we're doing is above board and ethical and transparent. And so we do our best from the governor's office to make sure that we do that from beginning to end. If there's a way that we can do this, however, more systemically, with a clear set of eyes on oversight and making sure that the tools are there, then that's what we'll wrap our hands around.
Thank you. Committee members?
Co-Chair President, could I add a bit to
please,
that?
Please.
Just as an auditor, you know, I talked about accountability earlier, and from the standpoint of just the responsiveness to the public, I mean, you talked about these members that are not elected, but also in terms of the expertise they bring, from our standpoint as auditors, we feel like that accountability needs to go to ultimately an elected official, and that from the standpoint of how you put state government together. I mean, there's Fish and Wildlife, Parks and Recreation, Lottery Commission, OLCC. There are many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of employees that answer to boards and commissions in Oregon. And from a coordination standpoint, from the fact that if someone doesn't like what an agency does, they call the governor's office, and the governor's office can, I presume, also, you know, tap into Department of Transportation and those others. But there is that notion of a direct link of accountability that I think has a value, and it's something that could be contemplated by the legislature. For example, the chief education officer in Oregon was a rethinking of how the education system would respond and be held accountable. Similarly, conversations could happen with other boards and commissions as you go forward. So I wouldn't necessarily say that you would just stop and accept as is a lot of those agencies that answer to boards and commissions, but it's a healthy conversation to have as well.
I guess I have to, this is a biased position, but I want to, I'm really concerned. I voted against, advocated against the governor's dissolving of the State Commission on Children and Families, giving that to a state agency, those responsibilities. I hope it works because I could care about children and families, but I had to put that on the record, I guess, is that what? Also, our committee administrator, Mrs. Norland, also brought up a thing that this committee's looked at is, do you have opinions on semi-independent status given to certain boards and commissions? Was it the insurance or the?
Accountancy, yeah. Co-Chair Wisnett, we just issued an audit earlier this week on the Oregon Travel Information Council, which recently received a large amount of highway dollars to maintain the roadside rest areas. It has historically been a semi-independent agency or entity, which allows it to forego a lot of the rules that we ask of other agencies. And the rules are put there for accountability purposes to show that they are putting, they're procuring in a way that achieves the lowest price for the best value. They're hiring in a competitive basis. They are not necessarily required to do that as a semi-independent agency. They're the second, they've gone from 2 or 3 million to about 10 or 12 million, as I recall, for their budget. So we did raise the question for the legislature to reconsider their semi-independent status, just given that they have higher risk dollars that they're responsible for in terms of the highway funds.
Good comments. I think it's all been good comments. Let me let's complete this item by what are our next steps? Hopefully we're not going to do a work group. Hopefully we're not going to have a pilot project. Do you foresee us having any sort of legislation that the three branches could agree work on this for the next session to propose some changes?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, we're beginning conversations with members of the legislature to begin looking at this. So we have this terrific starting point that the Secretary of State's office has given us, and much of what you've brought to our attention, issues, questions, possibilities, we're looking at as well. So those conversations are already beginning. We're actually really excited to kind of sink our teeth into this and maybe see that change happen that we've all been working towards.
Well, good. I think hopefully there's some efficiencies, but also it's, we're all these boards are providing a need for the citizens of Oregon, so hopefully we can refine that down and work on it. Vice Chair Hovey.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I was, I was having trouble getting the whole thought cockroach image out of my head. I don't know how anybody can pay attention to a question with that kind of image, but
you never forget the question.
In any respect, I was trying to search for one of the commissions that didn't respond, and it I search the intranet, I search the Department of Agriculture, I search Oregon.gov, and I could not find the Tall Fescue Commission anywhere. They keep saying it, no, nothing found. And I fear that I have a good friend that's on that commission, and I'm just kind of wondering, you know, how do you find these commissions and boards? You know, because I just, as a legislator and know a little bit about the state websites, can't find them. So how did you manage to do that?
Coach Erlevy, well, they existed on paper somewhere, and we tried to track down someone.
Yeah.
We do know that the Fine Fescue Commission exists, and perhaps that's why they've taken that name and not Short Fescue, because they feel like they're distinguished from the Tall Fescue Commission. I'm not sure.
They're hoping they're not in the weeds. That's all I'm sure.
Well, it seems like a really a big mountain of work that's going to be useful sooner or later, so I thank you for your work of putting this list together, so at least we have an idea who's running state government, or at least now we just have to figure out how to get a hold of them.
Hey, Representative Clem, you had a question.
Yeah, before we start commissioning the Commission on Commissions, I use this Google machine, and I just put in Oregon Tall Fescue Commission. The first entry has a little contact us, so I pushed that button on the Google machine. It says Brian Oslin, Administrator, 503-364-2944.
You have a direct link to the Department of Agriculture, though.
Maybe my Google thing is, I just intertubed it and web-tubed it, and got it. I'm not even in the 30s anymore. I'm in the next generation of technology now. Nice chair.
Director, you said you're working with the legislature. Is there a specific person or a caucus?
Right now, the beginning conversations have been with Senator Johnson and Senator Winters. We've also had conversations with Representative Greenlake. So we're beginning to just gather folks that we can have conversations with about this.
I would maybe suggest you see if anyone on this committee is interested in working with you, and also maybe Representative Nathanson.
Thank you.
Lobby government officials. If there's no other questions of this panel, we thank you for your work, we thank you for the audit, and we look forward to the product of for the next legislative session. We're going to take recess.
Senator Beyer would like to speak on the next topic.
Okay, good. We're going to go ahead. Thank you very much, panel. And we're going to close the informational hearing on audit of state boards and commission. Did we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to open a informational hearing on public construction contracting work group update. And we're very honored to have the Senator Beyer wants to speak on this. And then after the senator, we'll ask questions. I guess, will you take questions? And,
sure.
And then we'll have to recess because the next people to testify are not here yet, Mr. Underwood. So, Senator, thank you. Welcome to this committee. And thank you for your leadership on this topic of public construction contracting work group update. It's very much appreciated your attention to this, your leadership. And please identify yourself and speak.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Hovey, members of the committee. For the record, I am Lee Beyer. I'm the senator from District 6, which is the Central Valley area of Linn and Lane counties. And I just wanted to just kind of give an intro, if you will, to something I know that's been keeping you up at night, worrying about methods of contracting for public projects. Seriously, you may recall, or you may not, you may have wonderfully put it out of your mind, that during the 2011 session, we had a lot of constituents in the building from all sides that were very concerned about the use of public contracting, specifically what's called construction management general contracting, or CMGC is a short topic of that. I think your committee and mine on the other side of the building looked at this and said, you know, this is something that's fairly complex and we don't really know a lot about it, and maybe we ought to take it up in the interim. So what co-chairs Hovey and Wisnett and I did was look towards putting together a work group of people who did understand this, and when we first put it together, we literally, I think, had close to 100 people in the room who obviously had vested interests. I think that's probably a reflection of the economy at the time, But we wisely, I think, whittled that down and got representatives working with the various industry groups to form a work group. And then we followed that up by, I figured out pretty quickly that I didn't know enough about this, nor did I want to try and share it. So we asked the two of the top attorneys in the state who deal with public contracting to co-chair it, and they both agreed, and that is Blake Underwood from the Department of Justice and Jeremy Vanderlei from Vandermelia, I say his name wrong, who's a private attorney out of Portland, represents a lot of the companies, and they have done a very good job of working with that. One of the things that I would say is, at least my instruction, I think the two co-chairs agreed at the time, is a typical work group that we didn't set any preconceived ideas about what needed to be done or what outcomes to expect, other than saying we would like you to come to a consensus, and if you do come to a consensus, we will introduce legislation for you on for the industry in 2013. And we will. They actually are in the process. I think Ms. Nordland and Patrick Brennan on the staff are working with them to get a bill draft in by next week, so we have something that will be coming out. The only downside to that is we'd hope to be able to get something back out to the larger audience before we had it into drafting. That's not going to be possible just because of timing, but we are going to send out whatever we send down there, we'll send out to the larger group, and they'll have a chance to comment and, as you know, work on that on the interim. I have been very impressed with the work that they've been doing. Great commitment, not only in general meetings, but also in work groups. I think they're working hard, as is normal with our process. Not everybody is getting everything they want, and some people are getting things that they really didn't want. But I think it'll be a consensus piece of legislation that we can do at the end. My comment, my strongest thing when coming in, I said, what I heard the most out of people who were complaining, if you will, was the lack of transparency. They didn't know what was going on. A lot of the subcontractors said they didn't understand when they put a bid in to be a subcontractor, why someone was selected or how they were selected in the process. Those on the outside often thought that the public wasn't getting as good of a buy as they might be able to under traditional bidding. So those are, that's sort of the broad strokes of what was there. So that's kind of where they're at. You'll see it later. And certainly Ms. Underwood can answer more technical questions. My thank you to Representatives Wisnett and Hobie for working with me and my committee on this process. And I look forward to what we consider in the session. So, and Mr. Co-Chair, that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, and again, for your leadership. Do you want to take some questions, Senator?
I would be happy
to. Does anyone have questions of the Senator?
Except from Representative Hovey, who always throws a hand grenade down the hallway at about the time when you're done.
I think you did a great job of summarizing it, and you spent a lot of time and effort, and I appreciate it. I think you summarized it well. I think the other issue that I didn't attend as much as I should have and wanted to probably is, was there a subcommittee working on, you know, we were concerned about cities, small cities and school districts sometime, not, you know, that they just took the easy way out by going with that kind of contract instead of...
Mr. Chair, we did address that, or they are addressing that, and essentially through the requirement that any public entity wishing to use it will be following a model rules adopted by DOJ.
Good.
Subsequent to all that.
Super. Thank you. So no other questions. Have a great day. Thank you for testifying.
Thank you very much. Back to my meetings.
Yes. Thank you, Senator.
Just take a little recess until Blake arrives.
Okay. He's, our speaker is due here in 5 minutes. We'll just set it or take a brief recess at, for 5 minutes. We'll reconvene at quarter after, please.
Okay.
Hey, Marshall. These are the greatest.
Thank you.
They are.
It's a quality. It's a quality. What's the...
That, but I can fill in what wherever he leaves out.
Okay, your lateness is not my problem. Okay, we'll reconvene the House Interim Committee on General Government Consumer Protection. The next agenda item for informational hearing is the Public Construction Contracting Work Group update. Senior Assistant Attorney General Underwood, thank you for being here. And as Co-Chair Hovey told you, we got a summary by Senator Byer on all the work, and we complimented him, and we compliment your time and devotion to this effort, and we look forward to your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Wisdom, Co-Chair Representative Hovey. Just as a matter of background, I'm Blake Underwood with the Department of Justice. I am co-chair, or actually the chair, the single chair at this point, now I'm all powerful, of the Design and Construction Practice Group, which is within the Business Transactions section of General Counsel in the Department of Justice. So I focus on design contracts, construction contracts, and alternative delivery contracts of all different types. I assign work within the section and supervise work just for content level. I'm not a manager, but just a subject matter overseer of the work product. By way of general background, the way that I was originally requested to participate in the large stakeholder group, which Senator Byer may very well have discussed, which was a very large group of government representatives, private industry representatives, and contractors and subcontractors. I was met twice with that large group to discuss general issues. Then after a survey in the fall of 2011, where a number of issues had been identified that had been the subject of some attempts at legislation during the 2011 regular session. We kind of focused down a bit more on the issues in the fall, and then with Senator Byer and Representative Holby's assistance and their staff's assistance, we prepared a list of issues for discussion at a smaller group level. The idea was to have a subcommittee that would be representative, but would be a little bit more lean and able to actually touch the statutes and develop some suggested revisions to the statutes or new legislation that could be considered by the legislature in the upcoming session. So to that end, in January and then continuing on a monthly basis for the most part, but we got a little bit more excited here in the last couple of months. And we met twice in the month of August to further refine the legislation that the draft legislation that had been produced by the subcommittee. The general, by way of general summary, the main issues that representatives of the various different industry groups wanted to discuss really focused on four main areas. Outlined in my materials. The first area was the question of exemptions from competitive bidding. And I should back up a second. Most government construction contracts, from a traditional standpoint, use a design, bid, build method, whereby a construction contractor is selected on a low bid basis. In that sort of model, The government agency usually enters into a contract with an architect or engineer to design the project. That design is taken to a 100% level, and then the plans and specifications are produced, and those plans and specifications are used to go out on an invitation to bid basis to obtain a construction contractor to build the project that is specifically identified in the procurement documents. That is the traditional method. There are alternative methods that tend to disrupt the process and disrupt the participants in the construction and design process a bit. And that one of those is the construction manager general contractor model, which is one of the areas that was identified in the survey in the fall of 2011 as being an area of concern. And the construction manager general contractor model, there is it's different. It's not a pure design and bid and build method. In the design, bid, build method, the architect is really the advocate for the owner and watches the project and acts as the sort of the eyes and ears of the owner to make sure the project is done correctly. In the CMGC model, that same element is still present. The owner will initially do a procurement to hire an architect to design the project. Very, very closely, though, not waiting until the design is finished, very shortly thereafter, the owner will conduct a procurement to identify and hire the CMGC contractor, with the idea that that CMGC contractor will not just receive the specs and the plans and build it, but they will participate with the owner and with the architect during the design of the project. And the idea is to create a more collaborative environment to allow for the expertise of the construction contractor during the design process, especially if there's an unusual project, an unusual sort of design, the idea of getting the practical input of a construction contractor in the design process is seen to be essential and sometimes to create a more dynamic project, a faster project, a more efficient project. So the procurement for the CMGC takes place very closely after the hiring of the architect. Then this three-headed hydra, the owner and the contractor and the architect, then proceed with the design. And once they get the design to a fairly complete level, not necessarily 100%, but somewhere close to that, the construction contractor, who has just been performing what's called pre-construction services at that point, no building has taken place yet. So they are just meeting with the owner and the architect and talking about the design and reviewing plans and specs and having input on that process. They now know what the design is, and they will then conduct a subcontractor procurement process, which is not a public process. It's a private contracting process, to identify those subcontractors that the contractor needs to help the contractor perform the work. Typically, the CMGC contractor has certain expertise and will perform a certain portion of the work, but that percentage is usually relatively small, 10 to 20%. So the very large majority of the work to be done on the project will be subcontracted out. So once that subcontractor selection process has taken place by the CMGC, that contractor now knows approximately what the project is going to cost. They then will approach the owner and say, well, we know what it's going to cost now. Let's enter into the construction phase because we know that the government needs to know how much this is going to cost. And so we will now negotiate on the final price to build the project. And after those negotiations take place, there is usually at least in the state system, an amendment done to the main CMGC contract to authorize the construction work for a guaranteed maximum price so that the risk to the government is controlled and we know what the project's going to cost. That is sort of a traditional model where the full project is designed and the subcontracting process is done all at once. It can be done in pieces. And many times when you have a project that is phased and is on a real rapid delivery schedule, the phases of the work will be designed to the 90 or 100% level. And then those individual phases of work will be bid out in a subcontractor selection process. And those individual pieces of the work will be started by the construction contractor. And it's at, once you start constructing, that's when, for example, prevailing wages are established. Because now the contract is really a construction contract. Before, all the CMPC was doing was assisting with the design. Those are pre-construction services, more personal services. But now, once you've authorized the work, the various different requirements of the public contracting code pertaining to construction contracts have to take place, have to be complied with, such as prevailing wages. So those individual small phases of work are then completed so that the schedule can be maintained, and then the bulk of the rest of the work is identified, negotiated, and the full project is now under construction. I provided, as background information in my report, a brief summary of the CMGC process and the more conventional design bid build process to assist you. I suspect what I just said was sort of the fire hose approach, and it may be a little difficult to take in, but that summary is there to assist in that process. So in that CMGC process that I just described, the members of the subcommittee focused on four main issues, again back to the bullet points in the first section of my materials. They were concerned about the exemption process. A contracting agency, such a state agency such as ODOT or DOC, is not able just to do a CMGC contract or procurement without a special process. And ORS 279C, 330 and 335 set out a process whereby the agency has to prove to DAS, or in the case of ODOT, to the leadership of the agency, or in the case of a local government, to their contract review board, they have to prove that they have a project that is unusual and needs special consideration and would need a CMGC contract. That reviewing agency, I'll just use DAS as an example, then reviews formal written findings that the contracting agency produces and says thumbs up or thumbs down to whether the process appears appropriate for a CMGC contract. Once that, if they get a thumbs up from DAS or from ODOT or from the contract review board, then the RFP can be advertised and the procurement process begins. That exemption process, history has shown us there's been some issues with that, and so there was significant discussion of that exemption process. Then there was concern about the actual procurement that the contracting agency conducts with, for that CMGC contractor, as to whether there was, fair competition, whether there were enough firms participating in the process, et cetera. So there was a desire by the group to discuss issues with improving that CMGC procurement process. The next area that had significant focus for many folks in the process, both from the owner side, the contractor side, and the subcontractor side, was this subcontractor process that I described earlier, which is not a public contract, not a public procurement process, but nevertheless develops a number of issues and concerns that have recently come to, I believe, many legislators' attention. So we spent a great deal of time talking about the subcontractor selection process that the CMGC does to identify the subcontractors to perform the lion's share of the work. The fourth issue that we focused on and that folks were very concerned about was the question of enforcement. To the extent that an agency or a contractor doesn't comply with the process, to what extent can government hold those parties accountable? And there was a significant discussion about that in the sense that, well, there are those who understand the law, go about papering their files to comply with the law, but nevertheless, they may be conducting certain processes not in compliance with law. And how do we, how does industry, how does the individual contractors identify those areas of concern, and how do we enforce the law appropriately? And many folks found the current system difficult to manage in terms of basically contractors needing to take the initiative, hire a lawyer, and go and oppose an agency who possibly hasn't, you know, complied with the law appropriately. And many folks find that cost prohibitive or just difficult for them to conduct when they're busy actually building things. So we had discussion about those issues. I must say that we were actually fairly successful in making some progress, although I think you ask anybody in the process and it was a compromise. So there was movement on some issues that I'll discuss in a minute, but was everybody satisfied with that? Probably not. The area where we made probably the least progress, we had a lot of good discussion, but not much progress in terms of actual suggested legislation, was in this area of enforcement. There was a number of reasons for that. There was many of the government agencies felt like the existing legal processes were adequate to deal with the issues. Others felt like there could be difficulty in obtaining independence and funding for enforcement. A lot of folks were discussing the idea of it would be best to have an independent board or an independent agency or officer of some sort that would enforce these requirements. And there were issues with what agency would do that, what agency would have independence. There was some discussion of the Department of Justice taking on that role. While my participation in this subcommittee was really as a moderator and not as a representative of the department, I was instructed by the department to identify problems with that sort of solution, that the Department of Justice is set up to provide legal services for state agencies, and they're not really established to be a decision maker. They aren't really staffed for it, funded for it, that sort of thing. But maybe the most important issue had to do with conflict of interest. How would the Department of Justice effectively enforce these laws when there could be accusations that a state agency was in the wrong? We would have an obligation to represent the agency, and yet we would have someone adjudicating the same matter. So that would be really unworkable for the Department of Justice. There were other discussions about other groups taking on that role, but again, there was independence issues, cost issues. The main areas that were discussed in the last couple of meetings was possibility of an audit function, that through existing process that could be expanded or redirected, there could be an audit or at least the machine of audit ready to take on a particular project and identify issues possibly that with that process. There was also discussion of firming up a process called post-project evaluation. Under the current statutes, there is a requirement that anybody who has one of these alternative delivery contracts, not a low bid contract, has to submit a report to their contract review board or to DAS or to ODOT explaining how things went. Did you save money? Was it an effective project? Did you have good competition? Basically giving a post-project summary of how things went. And there was discussion about how some agencies are successful in doing that and some agencies not so successful at even preparing the reports. So there was some discussion of trying to make that process a little bit more substantive, make agencies more aware of their responsibilities so that that information would be available to the public for more transparency, and also to inform later requests for exemption. If someone requested an exemption and said, we will have good competition, there'll be no favoritism, we think we will have save money with this process. And then you do a post-project evaluation report, and actually, only one contractor participated. And then there was some question as to whether the favorite got picked, and there was no savings at all. Actually, it spent a heck of a lot more money than we thought we would. Well, so we were wrong. But that report will then inform a later request by an agency to do that process again. And maybe the granting agency, let's say DAS, would look back at an agency's recent projects and say, you haven't done very well. You did four of these. You spent a heck of a lot of money every time, well above what you thought you would. So we're disinclined to grant the exemption this time. So a lot of discussion about auditing and about possibly improving the post-project evaluation process, but we were not successful in the time period that we had in actually crafting draft legislation. However, we were successful in three other areas. We're in the throes of putting our final revisions to these chunks of legislation. The first topic was, well, I'll back up. The global sort of solution was to improve the exemption statutes, to make those exemption statutes a bit more substantive, to require not only a showing of no favoritism, competition, and cost savings, but to require the agency to show that there are other substantial benefits to using the CMGC process. That's a significant change proposed change to the legislation, to the current statutes. As a way of directing agencies in deciding whether there would be substantial cost savings and other substantial benefits, there was a very significant addition to the exemption statutes as to the factors that an agency would consider in making that particular finding. So we made dramatic subject matter and sort of expert participation, expert factors that an agency should likely need to evaluate to make a decision about whether to use the process or not. We then also created some draft statutory provisions specifically describing the CMGC procurement process. Under current law, there's an exemption process, but then there is no specific direction as to what happens after that. If a project is exempt, certain kinds of projects where there would only be, if you have an unusual project where only one contractor can really participate, an agency could just do a direct contract at that point. Typically, they do not, because there typically is not one contractor that can just do the work. So typically, there's a procurement process that follows, but that procurement process is just generally developed from the public contracting code provisions and from rules that have been drafted by the Attorney General's office to describe the procurement process. So the feeling was, let's not leave it to the Department of Justice and their model rules to set this. Let's, the contractors and the subcontractors and other industry reps are very interested in having that direction at the statutory level. So we created a draft process for CMGC procurements. That CMGC procurement process is, even though there's tremendous direction anticipated by the legislature on this topic, so that the Department of Justice can write administrative rules to further detail that process. The feeling was everyone had great respect for the CMGC administrative rules that have been developed by the Attorney General's office, and they were really the only rules that were used by state agencies or even local governments to conduct CMGC procurements. So the decision was made by the group to say, if you want to do a CMGC process and if you get your exemption from your granting entity, you have to use the model rules. Now, the members of this committee are probably well aware that under current law, the model rules set sort of a standard, and if agencies are unable to draft their own rules, the model rules are a backstop for them and give them a way to conduct their procurements. But there is an ability under that statute, which is 279A065, to allow those agencies to draft their own rules. They're not required to use the model rules. If they want to use an entirely different process, they can do that. If they want to use some of the model rules, draft some of their own rules, they can do that. However, with CMGC, the decision of the subcommittee was, we don't want to do that. We want to require government agencies to use the model rules for CMGC. If you don't want to use the model rules, you better do some other form of procurement because you can't do a CMGC. That required not only the new statutes dealing with CMGC procurement process, but it required a revision to 279A065. So we have generated some draft provisions to accomplish that new process, new way of doing things under the model rules. So that's those are really the delivery deliveries by this subcommittee. Revisions to 279A065 on the model rules, adjustments to the exemption statutes to put more teeth and substance in those exemption statutes, and then to create a new method for doing CMGC procurements. One of the significant areas of that new procurement process is some requirements for the CMGC contract that results from the whole process to have mandatory provisions dealing with subcontractor selection. So despite the fact that it would not be a public contracting process, nevertheless, the new statute would require the public entity to have in their contract with their contractor specific provisions requiring that specific processes take place at the subcontractor level to ensure transparency, accountability, open, fair competition. And so we were able to deal with that sort of third issue dealing with subcontracting by mandating that in this new CMGC statute.
Okay, thank you very much. So I also want to comment, this couldn't have happened, I think you'd agree, about the support of Jan Nordland and Patrick Brennan from the committee to help with this work group. So thank you, Jan. I think Representative Sheehan attended a couple of the meetings, work group meetings. So, committee members, questions, please. Representative, Co-Chair Hobie. We're going to put a limit on him.
Yeah, of all the people, I probably shouldn't have to ask any questions, but I did have a couple of quick ones. I just wanted to confirm, I think I know the answer to this, but do any of the changes to 279A that is being suggested have any impact on 279B?
They do not, Representative Holvey. Those edits are only to the CMGC construction process, not to goods and services, IT, or any other procurement under the code.
Thank you. So the next question may, I think you sort of addressed it a little bit, was about the post-evaluation by the agency and trying to beat that up. Do you, I know there was discussion about that, and that I don't remember really anybody objecting to the notion of trying to make that a firmer requirement of contracting agencies and somehow making those post-project evaluations public.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, the discussion, you're correct, it was on the idea that when the agency produces that report and sends it to the Contract Review Board or DAS or ODOT, that they would at that same time make that publicly, otherwise publicly available. Through a website was the most common method. ODOT already does that. There could be some mechanical issues with whether an agency has a website. Some of the smaller local governments might not maintain websites, but we could do that. It could be adjusted by saying they would otherwise give a notice that it's publicly available. And I think there was some other general discussion about trying to strengthen the provisions, but nothing specific. The specific provision had to do with not only producing it to the review board, but to publicly disclose the report.
That's all I have for you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think my presentation must have been so thorough and artful that, all questions were dealt with.
Mr. Underwood, consensus agreement, was there some issue that had, you know, was pretty close to equal support and opposition? Was any, what was the toughest ones that you had to get to consensus?
I think the subcontractor selection process was difficult because the many of the state agency reps that were there and the subcommittee already mandate subcontract process. So I think the state agencies especially and even the local governments were supportive of fair and open process at the subcontractor level. The contractors were concerned about the cost that if that was made too elaborate, too difficult, that there would be a significant increase in costs associated with that at the contractor level, which would then need to be passed to the owner and increasing costs of projects. But then many of the contractors in attendance admitted they already did many of the things that were being suggested. So eventually that was the contractors agreed to that, I think grudgingly so, but agreed to it because they did not want their hands tied so that on a given project they would have to use a rigid process when it might take more time. The subcontractors, I think, fairly late in the game were somewhat happy with where we were, but in one of the late meetings there was a discussion that some of the subcontractors were very unhappy about the level of attention to detail in that subcontractor process. They wanted to see more detail and more consideration, more standards put into the provisions to protect them, and so we were able to accomplish that in the last two meetings.
Good.
And so that was a little bit of a sticking point. Especially in that next-to-last meeting where I think one of the members said, well, there's a reason why some of the subcommittee members or the subcontractors have been coming to the meetings the last couple of months is because they don't see this going in the direction that they like. And so we immediately all stopped and said, well, let's shelve the agenda that we had planned to discuss. Wait a minute, let's talk about this. And we then spent the next hour and a half or so dealing with that issue to make sure that the subcontractors felt heard in the process, and we made some significant adjustments to their benefit.
Good. The other thing was I asked Senator Barr, I think one of the early meetings that I attended, we were concerned about cities and school districts not having expertise to really do this and that they automatically deferred. Senator Barr said that's what your model rules are for, those small cities and small school districts, that they will use when they use this CMGC contract.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, that's correct. They would be able to lean on those rules. The adjustments we made to the exemption process, though, included some requirements that the agencies show some level of sophistication to handle this difficult process. So, yes, the model rules would be some assistance to them, but if they don't have procurement people that are sophisticated to handle it, project management folks to oversee the project, legal staff to help them, then they would be in a tight spot. So the adjustments to the exemption require them to make a showing that they have adequate staff, either on staff or through contracts,
good,
adequate legal staff, adequate project management staff to handle this difficult method.
Good. Any other questions, committee members? Thank you very much for all your work. So then I guess the draft laws will come to Senator Barr. Is they going to start in the Senate? Is that the plan?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's the plan. We have I sent out the final draft implementing the changes from Monday's meeting to the key folks involved from my standpoint, just to get final comment on that. Ms. Nordland and Patrick Brennan and my state clients to make sure that I had, and to Jeremy Vermillier, my co-chair, to make sure that I had done a good job in implementing the final changes. I have to feel those final edits, and then I'll produce that draft to Ms. Nordland and Mr. Brennan, and so they can then produce that for Senator Beyer for him to transmit. I guess the plan is to get to legislative council on Monday, hopefully.
Very good. Any other questions for the witness? Thank you very much for your time.
Very welcome.
And all the work. Committee members, we meet in
December.
In December. We'll close this. Close the agenda item, and we'll close the hearing or committee meeting, and we'll see you in December.